Well, welcome, Joe, to WMUK. It's great to have you come into the studio and talk to us. You know, every time I turn around, you've got a new book coming out. And I swear, before the next half circle, there's another one coming on the way. What we're talking about today is Harder Ground, More Woods Cop Stories. But we'll talk about your other books as well. But talk to us first about Harder Ground.
Thanks for having me here, Zinta. It's nice to be back. It's been a while. These short stories grow out of observations I've made while working with officers in the field. You know, I do that for about a month a year in all the different seasons that they have, mostly in the UP, but I've worked downtown Detroit as well. So I've worked all over the state under all kinds of conditions. I work with a lot of female officers, and as you and I were discussing a minute ago, they're kind of a different breed of person. It takes a special person, special woman to be a cop, takes a special person to be a cop, but even more so, I think, for females, because there's some other issues involved in things. And I'm very impressed by what I see in the DNR Corps. They're really good at their jobs. They're passionate about it. They see it as a way of life, not just a way to get a paycheck. And that really shines through. And the main thing they do is, you see, I think women listen better than men. And you see that difference between female officers and male officers. Female officers really, really listen, and they use their brains, and it's kind of fun to be part of that. And over time, I've gotten to know a lot of them. My wife Lonnie and I are friends with several officers and their families, and so we're kind of intimately involved in what goes on in their lives. And I think we often forget that these people that serve in really dangerous jobs and challenging jobs also have lives as human beings beyond that, families, parents, and all of that sort of thing. So I just sort of accidentally started writing stories about some female officers in certain situations, some of which were totally out of my mind and some of which were based on things I actually saw. And this is what resulted. I wrote these in the summer of 2013, I think.
Okay, and only you would write something accidentally. How does that happen?
I don't think that's abnormal. I think that most writers have certain things that they write that they don't plan to write. They just pop out. I mean, Snowfly happened that way for me too. So that,
yeah.
But this is just one of those examples.
How many? Ballpark, is that number changing now with female conservation officers? Is there an upsurge these days of women choosing this kind of a profession?
No, they're having a very difficult time finding candidates that are interested. They're having a hard time finding males who are interested in it, because the age group that they're going at now is of a certain generation that's not so actively involved in life and have a really difficult time with the physical and emotional demands of the work. We have a class of 44 going through right now. We've lost 7 since it started in January. It'll end up at about 15 or 20% loss. We started with 4 females, and 2 of those are gone, 2 left. These 2 will probably make it. But it's very difficult to find women who want to do this, and then who can get through the academy, which is 22 weeks of really difficult things.
Now, you live in Portage, but you mentioned that you spend time every year up in the UP. Take us back. How did this all start? How did you get involved with woods cops, as you call them, but conservation officers? And how did you land in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan?
Well, the UP came first. When I was I grew up in an Air Force family, and my dad's last military station was what was Kinross Air Force Base, which became Kinchlo. And that's how I got to the UP, and I loved it as soon as I saw it, and I've been going back ever since. I wrote a book called The Snowfly and just arbitrarily made a character a game warden in that. And I didn't really know what game wardens did, and having finished that book, which was an accident, like we said a minute ago, I mean, I didn't plan it. I thought, what do those people actually do? So I called the Plainwell DNR office. There was a lieutenant there by the name of Corshane who was newly reported. I told him, or newly promoted. I told him who I was and what I did, and I was interested in finding out about what they did. And he said, well, come see me. So I went up there and met him, and we became friends, and I wrote the first book out of that. And then he was down here waiting for a promotion back to the UP to transfer. And when that came open, then he moved to Iron County, to Crystal Falls. And after the first book came out, I got they started asking me to come and ride with them. I can tell you a funny story from that time. I got a telephone call from the chief one time, who I had not met, who I heard was a real hard guy. He said, Joe Haywood? Yeah, this is Chief Asher. Yes, sir. I'd like to see you in my office. Yeah, his office is in Lansing in the Mason Building. I said, okay, Chief, when do you want to do that? He said, was tomorrow too soon? He was being really harsh. And I went, no, I can be there. What time? So he told me. So the next morning I got up and I thought, oh, boy, now this is after the first book came out, Ice Hunter. So I drive up there, park my car. I go to the in check-in and sign in. And he comes down. He's in uniform with all his rank and stuff. Doesn't say anything. Doesn't shake my hand. He said, follow me. We get in the elevator, go up to the fifth floor, and I think, well, he's about to kick my butt for I did something really wrong. I could just smell this. Walk into the office, he said, close the door and sit down. Okay. So I close the door and I sit down. He sits down behind the desk. He's got the big barrier between us. He looks across me and says, I got two bones to pick with you. I went, oh boy, this is going to be a short-lived deal. And he goes, one, he says, if anybody ever slammed a door like you had the guy doing this on the first page of your book, I'd fire him. And I thought, okay, that was stupid that I missed that because I knew better. And then he said, number two, he says, those old guys did not ride around with round bottles of whiskey under the seats of their cars. He said they kept flat bottles so they wouldn't roll. And he put his hand across, says, congratulations and thanks. Says, great. He said, you did a good job. He said, our files are open to you from now on. Anything you need, you just tell me.
And he meant it.
Yeah. And they've continued through several chiefs now. And they pretty much, I'll say, I don't even have to ask. I just call an officer and say, you want a company? And any place in the state, they take me along.
So any place in the state, isn't most of these ride-alongs that you do up in the UP?
Well, I do a lot of them in the UP, but I do this particular deer season, I worked Leelanau County and Benzie County and Newaygo County in that strip along there because mm-hmm. I didn't feel like making the drive up in the big snow up there. They had 23 inches there and only 20 where I was.
Wow. So the first part of, and how many books are there now?
9. The 10th one will be out this time next year.
The first is the Grady Service series, and you've been doing that for a long time, and now your relatively new start is with Loot
Babcat. Yes.
Okay. And then there's these short story collections. Not to miss that you also write poetry, you also paint, and then you're in the woods. Do you ever see your wife?
Yeah, well, when I'm in the woods and painting, we're usually together. And when I'm writing, she's usually painting in the same studio, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're together most of the time.
And she's your first eyes on your manuscripts?
She's my first eyes, yes.
So this one, being all female protagonists in these stories, did you have that special request for the women in your life to check, did I get this right? You know, it's very challenging for a male to write about the opposite gender and females to write about male genders. How were you able to do that?
I just didn't make an issue out of it. She knows that when I read something to her or give her something to read for me, that I expect her to tell me exactly what she's thinking. I don't, you know, there's no feelings to be hurt because I'm trying to make something here. And to make it, you need to get as much input as you can, so. That's never really been an issue. And she'll say, well, I don't think that sounds right. Or, you know, are you sure about that? And things like that.
Yeah. Now, by this point, you've ridden along with the COs up in the UP, certainly, so many times. Are you like an honorary? Do they think of you? And did I hear a rumor that somebody actually named their child Grady Service? Is that true?
Two of them now, Grady.
Well, I love it.
Yeah. I also have been told by 5 different COs that they went into the career field because of the books, which makes me feel a little awed by that. But like I've got a responsibility then to make sure that certain things are right.
Wasn't there a story, I think I've heard you tell at one of your readings, about being out there in the field and somebody brought up Grady Service? Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, it happens every now and then. A couple of years ago, I was out with a young CO in Luce County during bear season, And we pulled back onto this dirt lot road down to a kind of a turnaround. There were a bunch of trucks in there with all these bear dogs and bear hunters. And so everybody's standing in a circle like they do in the country, you know, kind of jibber-jabbering each other. And there's a little guy with a beard and white hair standing next to my partner, who's 6'5 or 6'6". And he looks up at my partner and says, "Who do you think you are, Grady Service?" And Derek, who is the officer's name, says, "Nah, he's a lot luckier with the ladies than I am." Of course, everybody laughed and all of that stuff. Nobody had any idea
that
who
the
I
author
was.
Is standing and right Derek there.
And he didn't miss a beat. He just hit his comeback. He said, "Well, we got to go, guys. We got a lot of work to do today. So, you know, good luck. Be safe." We got back in our truck and pulled out of there. As we got back out on the road, he looked at me, and we both came apart. He says, "If I'd have told him who you were," he said, "we'd have never gotten out of there. Our day would have been shot." So that kind of stuff happens from time to time. Not very often, but it does happen.
So are many of these stories, maybe all of these stories, taken from real-life situations?
No, not all of them. Some percentage of them, I couldn't tell you exactly, you know, whether it's 3 out of 10 or 4 out of 10. But all of them, every story I write so far that has to do with law enforcement grows out of something I have heard or seen or know about that business and what transpires in certain kinds of contexts that officers are engaged in. That's what kind of engages my mind then, as to, well, what if, you know, the old what if thing. That's what a fiction writer does, is what if. So that's a stimulus for me.
You must find yourself in some dangerous situations on occasion, though.
I have been, but I never feel it. I'm probably just stupid in my old age, but I always feel like the officers that I'm with are more than competent in handling it. I'm not a stranger to any of that kind of stuff, so I do know what to do. If we get into something that's really potentially dicey, we talk it over before we go in. And I've always told every officer I've ever ridden with right from the start, look, if we get into a deal, we get into a foot chase, there's no way I'm going to be able to keep up. I'm just going to be right here, so you come back and get me when you're ready. Or if we get into some sort of vehicle thing and you feel like you don't want me along, that I'm going to get in the way, then you just stop right there and dump me and go on. I'm fine. You can come back and find me. They've never dumped me or left me, so, and they just keep me going.
I think probably a lot of people may think of game wardens and conservation officers as people who tell you not to pick the flowers or check to make sure you have a fishing license. But what your books do is open our eyes to just how dangerous some of these situations are.
Well, the other thing that people don't realize is that they're fully empowered peace officers. They actually have more power than most of the cops in the state. Most of them, if they work along borders, are federal deputies, so they can cross state borders and international borders. They work with Homeland Security, the FBI. They handle every kind of thing that a regular policeman in your community can handle. They handle plus fish and game. So they're qualified as police officers, and then they get the DNR training on top of that. So they do everything. So if a cop is going to if there's a domestic call, sometimes we're the first ones to go there. Now, as soon as somebody from sheriff or state police gets there, we may hand it over to them. But we'll go first. Whoever's closest goes first. And we always back up other police when they're going into something, just like they try and back us up. But there are oftentimes in the Upper Peninsula in small communities, it's 3 o'clock in the morning and a call comes over the radio. The only person on duty is the game warden. And they didn't clean up whatever it is, car wreck, murder, suicide, drug bust, whatever it is.
Mm. Now, your stories are rich with characters, wonderful characters, and their names are equally fascinating. Tell us a little on how you choose these very unique names.
I have been keeping a list of names since I was in the Air Force. I have a notebook just filled with names. I started them out.
So they're real.
Yeah, they're all real names. Well, they're not all real. There are a couple that aren't, but they're the exceptions. Most of them I just get right out of phone books. Or at the time the Olympics take place, you get lists and lists and lists of all these athletes from all these different countries. It's a great source. Obituaries. You can go back into history and find all kinds of things. Lonnie and I wandered through graveyards writing down names. So you have to kind of actively harvest them the way you keep a lot of flies for certain situations. You might want to have that one. I try and keep a bunch of names like that, so if I need a particular one, I can just pluck it out of the collection and use it.
That's almost like a trademark of your stories, I think, is these wonderful names. So these days, the Loop Babcat, is Grady Service done, or
no.
you're bringing him back?
His 10th one comes out next spring. It's actually done. It was supposed to be out this fall, but because it's the 10th one, the publisher wants to do some publicity around it and make a big deal out of it being number 10. So I will keep going. I don't know. I don't know how many will be. This isn't the last one.
Okay.
People keep saying, well, he's done now, right? I go, when he's done, you'll know.
Yeah.
You won't have to guess. And the Loot Babcat series came out of the fact that lots of officers that I rode with would say to me, geez, I wonder what this job was like back in 1915 or 1916. Well, there are no records. Nobody knows. All the records burned up in the 1950s in a fire in Lansing. So I've been able to get my hands on reports that officers filed and stuff like that, small things, and I can imagine from there and build it around the history of what's going on. So that's why I started that series. It's been great fun. It's a lot easier to write and harder to write. It's easier because my imagination can do whatever it wants, and it's harder because I have to create everything that happens because I don't know exactly what they did.
And you use the dialect of the UP a lot, too. Is that challenging?
Yeah, it is. And I sometimes overdo it. As we discussed earlier, I'm trying to find the right balance, the right way to present this, and also the right amount to present. There are two issues involved.
To get that authenticity
in
there.
I want it to be authentic, but I don't want it to overwhelm anybody.
Yeah. And what is it about the Upper Peninsula that makes it so special? I mean, that's obviously a place you love and spend one of your homes, or is that home?
My home is here, but we live 6 months up there and 6 months down here. So we split the year. And unlike most of our contemporaries who go to Florida and Arizona in winter, we come to Kalamazoo. It shows it's probably some lacking in our judgment, but that's how it is.
What makes it so special? Is it different than wilderness elsewhere?
Well, yeah, it's not. I was in the Forest Service a couple of summers when I was in college, out west, Montana, Idaho, in those areas, and which is some real wilderness there. This is Jim Harrison once called this a wilderness by default, and it probably is that. But on the other hand, it's the only wilderness we have. There's not very many people, and the real joy is when you get out of your vehicle and you go into the woods. That's when you see what the UP really is. If you go to Tequamnon Falls and all those places, which are wonderful places, you're just seeing what somebody is feeding you to see. You have to find the UP on your own. It's like the Mosquito Wilderness area that is in all my books. It's an area, and people will go say, well, is that real? Yes, it's real, but I don't tell you where it is or what it is, because finally, in my thinking, you have to find your own mosquito wilderness, and there's lots of them up there for you to find, but you have to get out of your car to do it.
And it's very different than the rest of the state. I always feel that when I cross that bridge, Big Mac, as we call it, the Mackinac Bridge, something midway across that bridge happens. It's a completely different environment. In fact, haven't they talked about being another state, except maybe the economy wouldn't support it? Or
they have. They also, John Volker, who was the former Supreme Court judge and novelist, tried to lead a thing to blow up the bridge before they opened it. So they would die as another country, and they know that. So it's a standing joke. But it is a different place, because most people in the state don't think of the UP and as being part of the state. And lots of people who are not from the state don't even know it's part of the state. And lots of times when you see maps and weather and stuff, the UP doesn't even show up. It doesn't even there. It doesn't exist. It might as well be Mars. So there's a kind of a special feeling, us against them. And finally, they survive, as you know very well. They live in a really harsh climate and environment. And it takes special people to deal with that and just find a way to eke out a living. So I admire that.
So what are you working on these days? Poetry? Painting?
Well, does
the poetry and painting go throughout, even when you're working on a novel?
Sometimes, but I have not really painted seriously in 2 years. I haven't. But the poetry, I'm writing all the time. In fact,
do you have a poetry collection out?
I don't. I'd like to.
So that
should
be coming up.
I did. Yeah, I had a collection that I did called Fishing with the Famous. It was a bunch of poems about imagining what it would be like to go trout fishing with Shakespeare or, you know, a number of other people. There were a couple. You used a couple of them in the online magazine.
Yeah.
But we really couldn't find a sale for that. The other thing is I'm not academically linked, so most people who publish poetry really aren't much interested in me or anything I do because I'm not part of that club. And that'll change over time. I know that's just a matter of time.
Maybe you have to intersperse it between the stories. That's been done before.
Yeah,
a poem or two between the stories. Just kind of sneak them in there.
Yeah, I actually talked about that and thought about that,
yeah.
but not yet. So, I'm writing poetry all the time. But I don't consider myself a poet. I think I have a poet's sensibilities. But I don't have the skills that a full-time poet has. But poetry helps me to become more efficient with the use of language and develop metaphor in a more interesting way than I get from prose.
Any readings or any appearances you're planning in the near future with this new book, Harder Ground?
I've got a book signing and a reading in the UP in May, and then Rhinelander, Wisconsin in July, and then Bayfield, Wisconsin in September.
Anything in Kalamazoo?
Nothing. I had a reading in Richland in January, which was very well attended, and I talked about kind of the mechanics of writings, the kinds of decisions that writers have to make in creating things, and had a really big audience and a good turnout. I think they enjoyed it.
Yeah.
A lot of fun to do. It's a lot of time. I don't want to just go, hey, here's my book. So I want to, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Your readings are, I've attended several. They're great.
But I want people to understand they're interested in writing. They ought to learn some things or have access to learning about what it's all about.
Well, let's have a little taste here.
Okay.
I understand you've brought an excerpt of something or a
yes.
story.
This is just an excerpt from a book that'll be out in September. A book was published in 2005 called Covered Waters. It's a kind of a memoir, Tempest of a Nomadic Trouter. My publisher asked me to update it with a new introduction and about 50 pages more stories to kind of bring it into this century, which I've done. And this is from the new introduction. The introduction is called Keeping On, Keeping On. The root of the word wild means shaggy, and therefore one might conclude that wilderness is, in the words of author Scott Russell Sanders of the University of Indiana, an unruly, disorderly place where shaggy creatures roam. Amen, brother. In my parlance, I think of such locales as churches. October is pushing against November. Ice is forming month. Most of our abundant leaf crop is down after another splendid, gaudily colored autumn, and we are 1,500 feet up in the hills, 10 miles or so south of Lake Superior. We sit on a rocky precipice 30 feet up from a granite bowl, which is 100 yards south of the lip of a 150-foot vertical drop. Earlier in the day, we dumped a roadkill deer into the small cirque immediately below us, knowing that wild creatures easily make their way up the cliff to the plateau below the ancient straight-trunk maples. As the afternoon finally begins to push against dark, we see materializing below us a pack of five wolves moving toward the meal, their heads down, choreographed and crouched in hunting postures, advancing in a weave that leaves me thinking of high school basketball drills 6 decades ago, the wolves moving as we moved in the fuzzy past of memory, one crossing behind another as all advance forward until the lead animal comes to the carcass, and the player with the ball gets the dog shot for an easy two. Individuals pass and move and pass and move, and if this is done relentlessly and effectively, the group prospers. Our weave was a game. The pack of wolves lives and prospers, or fails and dies by team behavior. Men become hermits. Wolves don't.
Always a pleasure, Joe. Thank you for coming in to talk with us.
Thank you, Zinta. A lot of fun.